Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 17th, 1999, and in the Fireside Room this afternoon, we will have a presentation by Edna Hansen, and she will be talking about our eternal tree of life, our brain, the language of learning. And this is tape number 99-3. So let's now join Edna in this discussion time.
A prayer for children. Pray for children who go, who give us sticky fingers and kisses, who hop rocks and chase butterflies, who stomp in puddles and ruin their new pants, who sneak popsicles before supper, who erase holes in their math workbooks, who never find their shoes, and pray for those who stare at photographers behind barbed wire, who've never squeaked across the floor in new sneakers, who have never counted potatoes, remember doing that game? Who are born in places we wouldn't be caught dead in, who never go to the circus, who live in an X-rated world. And pray for the children who bring us fistfuls of dandelions and sing off key, who have goldfish friends and build card table forts, who slurp their cereal on purpose, who get gum in their hair and put sugar in their milk, who spit toothpaste all over the sink, who hug us for no reason, and who bless us each night. And pray for those who never get dessert, who watch their parents watch them die, who have no safe blanket to drag behind, who can't find any bread to steal, who don't have any rooms to clean up, whose pictures aren't on anybody's dresser, whose monsters are real. And pray for children who spend all their allowance before Tuesday, who throw tantrums in the grocery store and pick at their food, who like ghost stories, who shove dirty dishes, no, I think it's dirty clothes under the bed, and never rinse out the tub, who get quarters from the tooth fairy, who don't like to be kissed in front of the carpool, who squirm in church and scream in the phone, whose tears we sometimes laugh at and whose smiles can make us cry. And we pray for those whose nightmares come in the daytime, who will eat anything, who have never seen a dentist, who aren't spoiled by anybody, who go to bed hungry and cry themselves to sleep, who live and move but have no being. And pray for children who want to be carried and for those who must be carried, for those we never give up on, and for those who we don't have a chance, for those we mother, and for those who will grab the hand of anybody kind enough to offer it. I think that says something for all the children of the world. And I think most of us have known one of those children, and a lot of them are our own children, the fun parts, you know, with the sticky fingers and so forth. And even though this is all about something technological as the brain, the more I've been at Holden, this is my very first time, the more I hear Pastor Mays and others that I've gone to, the more I think I know how to help all of us understand the brain and all of this technological and scientific business with a different kind of sensibility that is very, very important here. I'm getting there. The part that's important about knowing about our physiological self is knowing that why we don't have to push children and why we shouldn't hurry up the process. And the fact that everything in our life is speeded up, except here, except when the bell rings. But we're doing it to such an extent that we are harming children. And I know that it's very, very hard for me to say this to a lot of young mothers. I love to see the grandmothers in the group, because when I say natural is the way to go, bringing up the children without all the increments of society, which has given us the wind-up swings and the rocking boats and the jumpy chairs and all of this, is not for their benefit, but is really, in a physiological way, actually detrimental. I get a couple of grandmothers came over to me, and aside from a lot of others, but they said, "I'm so glad I did it the right way." And I said, "You really did." And it's very hard now for young mothers to understand, because our media is always giving us information about what we need and what we should have, and showers are phenomenal for giving, gifts as a wind-up swing and a big thing to hang over the crib with all the great things that swish back and forth and they're all colors. It's very difficult to go against this. And the woman that comes to my center to give the 80-hour intensive training for teachers who teach in the colleges about infant care, and for people who are opening their own infant care centers, is an advocate for all of this natural learning. And she was trained by a medical doctor, so she discovered why it was so important not to have those things. And from a physiological standpoint, we have to be sure that we are allowing the infant to exercise the neural brainstem that goes from their little bottom right up to the back here, and the old brain, and into the hierarchy part in the limbic system. And if they are put into these contraptions, they cannot have that kind of activity that will allow it to be stimulated. Consequently, I'm going to talk about 4 and 5 and 6 year olds today, and if they haven't had the right allowability to do that, then we are going to see the problems in the 5 and 6 and 7 year olds. I have a video. I hope that it doesn't get too big like the last one. It got enormous. That will show you the doctor in Chester, England, Dr. Blythe, who has for the past 15 years with his partner, now his wife, Sally Goddard, researched and found that the inhibition that didn't take place of the old reflexes that the infant was born with is what now causes, in later times, 5 and 6 year olds, a lot of the learning problems. And this is pretty phenomenal. We keep going back and back to find the reasons for all these difficulties that children have in school. So I want to advise anyone who knows little people, or parents that have little people, or your daughters, or you, to just relax and know that children can be stimulated by bottle tops and plastic bottles that don't have scratchy edges, and lots of boxes of different sizes, and one of the best teethers, the soap. Little plastic soap object that you put on sinks to keep the soap. A brand clean one is great for teethers, because you don't need to buy the plastic one. Anyway, there's so many things that we don't have to go to the merchandising people to get. And these were all things that were used in the past, except for maybe, I don't know about the soap thing. But today, because we have come through most of the beginning times, the infant, the prenatal and the infant, and later on that first year of life, and I kind of gave a back look at that for some of you that I don't think were here before. And I'd like to now talk about that rich environment that should be there for the third, fourth, and fifth year, beginning third and fourth at least. And this would take in not only the home situation, but the daycare centers. And actually, it's quite as simple as we were just speaking about for the infant. But now we have to look at a new word that has come about in the field of early childhood, and that is something to do with the senses. And it is such a new word. Every time I go to say it, I say it wrong. I'm not kidding. This is the books that were also has to do with the brain. It is a sensuality. That's the word. Sensuality came about because the schools in the Reggio Emilia, Italy, which are to all of us who are in early childhood and looking for the best, have been proclaimed by doctors as well as educators to be the best in the world for children from 2 years through the sixth year. And the one that was actually designed the curriculum, but they don't call it curriculum, designed the program for these schools, and there are many in northern Italy, with Louis Malagusi, that's the doctor's name. And he based the beginning experience of learning on the senses. God gave us these marvelous senses of smell and touch and vision and taste. And we also add that sixth sense of kinesthetic ability to move. And if these senses are explored, or if you have the environment that will allow them to explore it with the natural increments that we have in our world, the child is going to become accustomed to his world, and he's going to discover what the reality is of his situation, not necessarily the plasticity, which is a lot of plastic toys, etc. So I've tried to do this in my place, where we don't buy the thinking of some of the names of the most current Toys R Us stuff. We use all the natural materials that we can find. Fabrics are wonderful for stimulating the tactile senses. You can make boards of different kinds of feeling sensations, from the smoothest piece of plastic linoleum or whatever you can find to the roughest sandpaper, the seashells that we can glue to the bottoms, etc. I think some people have made these, I can see. And what this does besides stimulate the neural endings in your fingers, which are phenomenal computers, they really are, we not only touch, but we feel rough and soft, and actually we feel pain. That's another part of the tactile sensation, wet and dry and a multitude of other things. It also develops a dialogue of descriptive words that sometimes come earlier if a child can explore this way than if they don't have access to all of this wonderful natural material. So the sensibilities of tactile information are just one of those many ways to enhance, this is actually enhancing brain development. Then there are ways to find what light is really all about. And we seldom take time with little people to explore the wonders of light that God put in our world, and the difference between dark and light, and the way that we have been given a shadow. And there was some writings from the children in Reggio Emilia that the book says that ants are the only ones that don't have a shadow. You know, I've never thought about that, but I think I'm going to try to find out. I've never thought about ants and their shadows. But they studied shadows. And why do we have a shadow? You know, and then you discover the dimensions of our being. So many wonderful things that God has given to us, but we kind of have eliminated so much of this from our little people. You know, we give them things. We don't have to go to all that expense. And when we go out with our children in the rain, I did a series of tapes for a college program, and I called it that From A to Z, and taking one letter at a time, and I can think of not all of them, but for instance, rain. If you go out into an environment outside with a little person or your class, and you see what rain has done to the earth, and you can see raindrops hanging on the trees, and if you look at the right time, the sun comes through and you see the rainbow, and the squishy noises that the cars will make in the road or whatever's going by, and all these sensations of sound are another thing that enhances the child's ability to understand the world, as well as every time you do something like that, he's finding a new sensation and he's growing another dendrite to go to another brain cell to get more intellect. I mean, all of these things are all natural.
Yes? To ask a question, I saw a presentation at one time in regards to sensory that sometimes children are not as tactile or something, and then when a parent touches them, they'll respond. And as adults, we don't necessarily know how to decipher that they're telling us don't touch it. Are you familiar with that?
There is it's an aphasia that is a lack of tactile discrimination, so that their sensitivities are so high that any touch will really excite the nervous system and actually cause them pain. A lot of autistic children have this condition. And a lot of children that haven't been labeled are still a little reluctant to be touched. Mm-hmm. And it goes back to beginnings. It goes back to something, the sensitivities that occur from birth on. If it is an autism, that's a totally different situation. Mm-hmm. But we've had children come into the center that are tactfully defensive. Mm-hmm. And we never want them to, you know, really be able to be with it right away. One way that you can disinhibit that is to start with the softest soft. I mean, the soft toys, the soft boards. I've got some boards that are just totally made out of different kinds of fur fabrics and different colors and different levels of fur. If they begin on that level, they can sometimes graduate to more and more sensitivities. They haven't had access to enough of this to excite down that nervous system.
So how would you gather that information, from a historical background, or would you observe them behaviorally that when you do that touch, the squinching?
There are books that explain this. Dr. Delicato at the Center for the Development of Human Potential in Philadelphia worked with tactically defensive children and had some methodologies in there that can be used. It's not an unknown. I mean, it's quite, you find it in quite a few daycare centers will I have this. I had been asked, you know, many times, and I think that it also can be emotional. It depends on the age of the child, you know. If some trauma has occurred and the touch factor has to do with something that's been abusive, then you're going to have to see it in a totally different way. Then you treat it just from what's called active listening, and you try to get feedback from the child, and you feedback everything they say to you until they feel the sense of trust is built up. But I'm just exploring, you know, from a normalcy of children that if they are allowed to explore those kinds of amounts of materials. And I mean, it goes outside too, looking at a leaf and learning. If you are have a sensitivity to life's products, you know, or what Earth is full of, what God has given us, you become revered of it. You have a reverence for it. If something, when I wrote my page for Holden, what I had to write about what I am, I said that I was born with I was blessed to be born with a father that would take me for walks as little as I can remember. And when I could remember, I know that we never walked more than 5 or 6 steps, and then he'd find something. And we'd pick it up and look at it and really know that it was special. Even if it was a little leaf with a tiny little bug, you know, it was one of God's creations. And that, if you begin with that, you know, you have it for a long, long time. And the older you get, you can develop some mighty fine ecology people. I've got a couple of children and they're really looking at the earth. And I think that we used to do a lot of this in school before we got quite so academic. I can remember my 50-year-old in kindergarten, and she had they had a slug race, which is, you know, in Washington you can get a lot of slugs. There are beautiful slugs. There's pink ones and spotted ones, but I remember in her kindergarten they all brought in the slugs, and they had little boards to see which color would go the fastest. And these were special creatures. And sometimes they get out of place and eat your flowers. But God created them. And then they talked about, look at the trail they left. And then the teacher, the wonderful kindergarten teacher, said, what could we do with that? And they talked about having a glue factory in the kindergarten. But every kind of life form can be a mystery and can be a sense of wonder. And if a child grows up with a sense of wonder, they won't lose their bearings and ever think about drugs. I've had talks with the children that, I'm saying children, I'm thinking about 14, 15, and 16-year-olds who have gotten into those situations, and they didn't have that sense of wonder about how exciting life was. Somewhere along the way, they lost it. And I think they lost it pretty early on. And I think that it's pretty sad. It's much more important than all the academics in the world. And those are, in a sense, it can be involved with an academic life. I mean, if a child is interested in slugs, you get a book on slugs and you look at it together. And whatever else you can find. Because we're talking about sensibilities, I would like us to do one thing just to see if it's possible. Every new sensation a child encounters is like a little miracle. And we are, you know, as grown up as we are, can you just close your eyes, or you don't have to close your eyes, but think about one new sensation that you can remember as a child and what it was. I'd like to hear if it's possible you can feedback.
A sweaty horse and the smell of the sweaty leather and the it's just a wonderful. And it sounds so stupid, I know, but it was just.
Oh no, it doesn't.
Very. I loved horses.
Uh-huh.
And just, you know, to be around them was exciting. And then to have ridden one, and you know, and there's the hot and the sweat, and it was just very.
It's fabulous. But I'd like to talk about smell later on too. That's fantastic. Can I hear from somebody? Somebody did remember something?
When my mother made bread, she'd always give me a piece of bread, and you know, I would play with that bread. So then I always let my children, and they liked to the yeast and the little bubbles, you know, in the bread, they would pop.
Oh, I can smell it. Yeah. Yes.
I remember on a really, really hot Baltimore summer, sitting on the back porch of my grandma, with a really flabby upper arms. It was so cool.
Gee, what a wonderful remembrance. God.
The sensation of going down a sidewalk on roller skates, on roller skates.
Did it make you
hold your breath? I remember at 4 being on a train going, I guess, from Eastern Oregon to Wisconsin, and standing for the first time in that coupling place between two cars that was real jittery, and the walls, I think, were not solid, but I don't know, canvas or something, but there were windows open to the night air, so there was this night air coming in, and the sensation I remember was the jiggling of the coupling place, I don't know what it's called, going all the way up my legs, and I... And then I remember my father, who was with me in this dark night place with the night air coming through and this jiggling feeling, went through the door into the train car. And I remember this dilemma of, should I follow him where it was safe and more enclosed and more stable, or should I stay in this kind of in-between place that smelled so good and felt so cool and was dark and vibrating?
So,
I think that memory, I know I was four, because my mom had polio and was on this trip with us, so that's why I was four. I think that memory is almost a parable for my whole life. We're staying in that very sensual
place,
alive, exciting place in the dark between two safe cars, or whether to follow my dad into relative safety where my other siblings were. That's what came back to me. I think it's, it was a total body thing. And there is a place I get some of that same feeling here at Holden at this time of year, if you would like to have it, which is on the bridge that crosses 10 Mile during spring melt that goes to Monkey Bear. And there are open slats so that there is this sense of danger there, the sense of air and water rushing, the sense of movement. And to stand on that bridge when the water is very high and it's dark, and you're really between two safe places, you can get that same kind of total body rush.
That's
if you're interested in it.
Yeah, I'm going to try.
It's lovely.
Time goes too fast. But it shows that sensations that children have excite, take pleasure through them. If it's, you know, if tactile, I've seen them like that, you know, and those sensations that you had, they do make differences in your life. And just awe and wonder can really give us a lot of good things to carry on that we'll use later on. All of these sensations, when we take a look at the brain things, I'll explain where they come from, but they're involved in our makeup. And now that we understand that the molecules of emotion, which molecules are in our body, millions of them, are linked so closely, now this wonderful lady, Candace Pert, has proven that there is such a link between the positive and the negative molecules, the lingads that link on depending on the frame of mind from the higher parts of the brain, from the limbic system, will be good or be not good to your organs, etc., and everything. So we've got to realize that in children, I don't know if you think as I do, but a couple of doctors and I were speaking about children that get a lot of colds. And sometimes it's definitely because they've been exposed and have picked up a virus. But there are some that just continually seem to have colds, and even the doctors can't figure it out. But there must be behind that a disturbance of some kind that this little person can't quite understand or hasn't been helped to, you know, overcome it. Emotional, that they haven't got the dialogue to give, you know, to talk with about it, haven't got the words, and that this goes along with a lot of other things we're discovering about children now. And I think that everybody's heard about asthma, and they're looking at this is a physiological, it's not that it is not in the body, because it is, but it has become, you know, these lingettes and these molecules have gotten together and said, well, this is a good place near the bad guy, so we're going to, those lingettes that hook on are not going to be out of there until we clear that emotional situation up, which is something we have to consider with every time we speak to a child. Children that I should be, this is very difficult for me, not too much. The way we speak, tonal differences have a lot to do with children's development. And they make a lot of noise, and their voices go up and down, because actually what they're doing is trying out what they have vocally. A lot of them like to hear themselves, and they do it pretty loud. And this is very irritating to a lot of adults. And when they get excited, they go higher and higher and higher. And I have one teacher, she loves the children. She gets so excited that I'll have to go like this, because she gets just like the children, you know. And of course, adult voices are always louder, you know. So, but if it's a situation too where something disturbing, or, you know, some child has really caused a disturbance, there's always two, it always takes two. I know the minute you raise your voice, you know, if you, and this is hard for moms, because as a mother, we have a different situation, but particularly in a daycare center or in a school, I'll tell the teachers that the minute they raise their voice, they have lost their stature. Because as soon as you speak and raise, you're on the same plateau as the child. And if you speak quietly and calmly, no matter what has happened, they're going to respond twice as much, or they're even going to sense it, and they're going to be able to calm down enough to explain to you, you know, I want to know how you feel. And you say it on a quiet way. Yeah, it's really hard at home, you know, when you have a 24-hour thing. And I tell moms, you know, do the best you can, but, you know, I was there too. I couldn't holler to my mother. I mean, we never did that, because she had a rash. And if the voices got too high, her little throat, and I'll never forget, it was so frightening, I would never do it. So I never learned to holler. And I can remember in school being told over and over, Edna, speak up. I couldn't speak up. And I tried to get a job once in the summer, just for fun, and my girlfriend and I were going to go in and try to get jobs in this big ice cream parlor. And we got the job, and I was supposed to get the orders from the little seats around the perimeter, and then the man that owned it wanted me to holler over to him. Two cones with, I couldn't do it. I kept running back and forth. He felt real sorry for me. He gave me a big ice cream cone on the way out. But I think it's something that comes from something where you've been, you know, whether you holler or not.
Can I ask you a clarifying question?
Sure.
Did you say that some physical illness can be induced by emotional deficits?
I don't say induced, but there is a physiological process. There's a book called Molecules of Emotion. This woman had been researched for years and years, I read many articles, and then I found this book, we have will, and we have the conscience that we can decide. And I'm not saying it can work. I mean, I think, I live in a state of gratitude. I have two artificial hips, and I'm glad that they found out how to do this. But I don't have debilitating things like cancer or something. And for people like this that have those kinds of diseases, they have had, in Texas, they have had a research center where the positive imagery of the fighters against the cancer had worked. But then it's 50-50. Some have not. And some of the people that have tried have been wonderful human beings that could not bring this about. But what this woman researcher found on a molecular level, that there are these lingeds, they're called L-E-G-U-N-D-S, and the peptides, and all of these are involved with our molecules in all of our organ places and parts, that they seem to have an alignment to a positive or negative condition, whether we're a depressed, or whether we are a person that can ride with a storm or whatever.
And I've seen it's very hard. Adults, that they have the somatic complaints where it's more emotional and it's representing itself in a physical. So I was curious if, looking back in early childhood, if that was some of it that happened in them.
Well, this is a new whole area of research, and we're trying very hard to, I have different students in different university programs that will send me pages, and it's pretty amazing how many are coming, so that you can hardly keep up with it. And I had to read the molecules of emotion, I had to read every page 3 times, but she writes it in a beautiful way, because she has children of her own, and she's doing this research, and she had a 4-year-old, and she went to go back to the lab to do something that would, allow her to go on with it in the morning. And her husband is a researcher in another place. He called up and said he couldn't pick up the 4-year-old from the center. Could she do it? So she picked up her little fella and took him to the lab, and then put him on a big table with about 50 different little bottles to take the tops off. So he did that and was very entertained while she had to go on with her research thing for the night, so it'd be all right in the morning. It's amazing that we are now into exploring our bodies, and what God has really created here is pretty fantastic. Mm-hmm. We only know half of what we really are, and what we really are is pretty amazing anyway. But we should be thankful.
Another thing I'm interested in, if your center has worked on all, because our culture is very anti this. Just read, Dear Abby every 8th week, it'll pop up. And yet we had a Japanese man come to live with us when my son was 2, and he was appalled that my son had his own bed. And he said, at what age? And I went, ooh, I don't want to answer this question. Well, the day we brought him home from the hospital, he had his own bed. And he said, oh gosh, till 5 or 6, our children sleep with us. Does your center do any
those studies? It's a European practice as well, and I think that mostly it's come about that they have their own bed because we are a health conscious nation, and from early on, this certainly wasn't true in the pioneer days, and the people that come over from different countries, and even the New York population, the immigrants certainly didn't do this. But I think that more of the push has been to the cleanliness and the hygiene. And
but do you think it affects brain development, I guess is my question.
I've never heard that it did. Bonding begins at birth, I think that in one respect, I think that children like to feel that they've come to that place where they can have their own bed. That might not be true. I know my half dozen all were glad when they got their own. They were lucky enough to be able to have their own and not have to be pushed together. But we did do fun things like make clown beds where the clowns had their arms here to keep them in, and the feet stuck up on the bottom, you know, and head was up, all kinds of things like that. But I really don't know about brain development in regards to beds. I have to think about that. I have charts here because I thought, well, you know, people want to know where the things are in their brains. As we go through the parts of the brains, there's one part has to do with reading that I really think is fun to talk about. But as we look at this fantastic piece of thing here, this is the brain stem on which all the appendages and the lower parts of the body feed up through the brain stem to the hierarchy part of the brain. So that there is a vestibular doorway. Besides, you've heard about the vestibulars in your ears, you know, that makes you dizzy or not. You know, you have to be able to deal with that with gravity. But there is a little opening in the old brain at the back of the medulla here that lets the neural flow come up the spine. The spine goes right down here. We found that when that is not totally open, then the vestibular activities we have to do, and I have a paper here with all the things we do in my lab school, has to be reactivated again to get the passage cleared, to get information from everything you want to send messages. The brain has to get it down and up. This is very vital to have it open. And we do these sensory integration activities to clear the vestibular system. It's kind of like the things you see about blood vessels with the cholesterol buildup. And this can also happen in the system going up to the brain. And we'll get there. This is the cortex at the top. The information from there feeds back through these systems that the neural passageways have told the cortex what's going to happen. Now, to get back there and tell this arm to move and this foot to go this way and all of the limbs and all of the writing and everything that you function with has to come from the top. But in order to have it come there, we have to get the sensation up there that we want to do it. So after we have the brainstem, then this is the cerebellum here. We call it the little brain because it's right there behind the big one, and it has so many activities, and it does govern movement. My Velcro is going. I loan it to just so many places. So this has to do now what's happening with brain research is that we are finding more and more kinds of activities that are delegated to certain parts that we never knew they did all that before. This not only is with movement, but it has some sensation of emotions. We're going to find, I think, eventually, that everything is integrated in the brain. You know, every part has something to do with every other part. Just the way it's that way with life. You know, we should be as it's black, white, yellow people. I mean, what is everything should become integrated to have information from all parts, and you grow by the diversity and the richness of everything. And on top of this, now we get here the limbic system, which is just a really integral part with the pituitary gland, which used to just govern growth, you know, how big or tall or whatever. Now it has a lot of other functions, and it has to do with illness and wellness and so many things. And these things are just coming about. So the two thalamuses are really not hooked together, but I had to, because I had to get it to fit on here. And then the hippocampus, from the little armadillos here, like little acorns. I get over here, know that the children in the schools just love to take this brain apart and put it back together. I mean, they think that, wow, that's beautiful. Wow, your brain is beautiful. You know, when it's not alive, it's a mass of off-white matter. But when it is alive, it is sparkling. I saw a synapse that was sent from England when I was in the Dr. Hahn's research, brain research class in the General Hospital. It was one synapse that was made, and they did it from a cat brain. One synapse, you know, one axon sending the message down to the dendrite, and then the synapse, it never touches, but when it gets that close, there's an electrical charge. Have you seen one?
Yeah.
And it's like the 4th of July. When I'm talking to you, there's thousands of them going on in my brain. Wow. Anyway, this is the corpus callosum, and that's very important because there's the bridge between the left and right hemisphere. And then all this wonderful time we spent on right brain and left brain. And some people right brain said, you have to be both. You couldn't live in this world if you were just one part, you know. You couldn't be a left brain person. It would be dreadful. And you couldn't be a right brain person because you'd be 2 feet off the ground floating around someplace with all your artistic whatever. And the important thing is that this is a way of communication from both sides, and it's constantly the neural cells are exchanging information. The fun part is, here we go. The fun part is that I think it's women have more. Well, I know it. I know it by heart, but I want to make sure I know it. It's really important. The corpus callosum contains millions of nerve fibers which facilitate communication, instantaneous feedback from one side of the brain to the other. Women have 40% more of the corpus callosum than men, which means that they can see different things, you know, different... like when you're home, you are doing the dishes, but you're... little one comes and wants a peanut butter sandwich, and your husband comes in the door and says, did you pick up the whatever? This is an attention thing that we seem to have the ability, and men have our sort of, would really want be one track, you know, much more comfortable than, and I don't think that has changed any. And maybe it's important because they're, in the past, anyway, were the job seekers, and you know, their attention span had to be delegated to a specific chore, and we were designed to do what we had to do. And then,
I heard that, let's say men might only speak 4,000 words a day, and then women can speak like 12,000. I mean, is that the same
that has,
activity of the communication?
Yeah, well, yeah, it definitely has that. And I think if you think about little fellas too, because this gets into the reading part of the hemispheres, and I'll read that as soon as I get my cortex on, which is at the top of the brain, as you see there. And I'm having trouble with my... I'm so sorry. Should have brought that big... thank you. This is... It performs all the higher functions here. And I made it this way because these are the places that are now on, you know, electrified. And, I mean, it happens here, there, and everywhere. But I have pearls of wisdom in here, too. Mm-hmm. I think I haven't counted them lately. But this is this beautiful, beautiful brain that God gave us. And when children find out what they've got up here, they are amazed. And they really want to take care of it. And I've given this talk in high schools, and I will have some come up and say, well, I had a little pot, you know. And I'll say, well, you know, now if you go on a cleansing, maybe you can use... We use only a part of our brain cells. We have the the possibility of using tons more than we do. And you want to preserve what you got, because you can be amazing. You can be anything you want to be. But if you mess it up, because there's like five kinds of chemicals in every cell, and once you start to take the kinds of things, and the book, Molecules of Emotion, this is how she found out. She was studying AIDS and the things that it did to the brain. If you disturb one of them, one of them's like baking soda, you know, but if you disturb the content just a little, you're going to knock out your full potential possibilities. You know, when I talk to young kids like this and they don't realize the wonderful, wonderful gift here, you know, it's like, wow.
I saw a little clip on it. I can't remember what the film was. It was about 15 minutes, but it was about alcoholism.
Mm-hmm.
And it showed a brain of someone who was an alcoholic and a brain of someone that hadn't drank. And when they cut the brain of the one that hadn't drank, it felt just like bread sliced. But when they sliced the brain of the alcoholic, it crumbled.
That's really No, I brought that. That was my tactile board, but I didn't have enough room to put it all. Thank you. Reading, everybody wants to know about reading and children. In initial reading, the balance of the brain activity favors the right hemisphere. We're talking about hemispheres. But later on, it defers to the left. And see, one hemisphere looks at the pictorial part of letters, etc., and pictures. The left is dealing with the logic and the detail, so that you need both sides. And the exchange of brain activity, this is fascinating to me. The exchange is really activated between the years of 6.5 to 7.5 years. And that means, you know, this is where understanding what you read is wonderful. A lot of children can read at 4 and 5, but they don't understand. Their comprehension is, you know, it's funny. This is the same age at which a major period of myelination, which means the covering around the nerves, are linking things between the vestibular apparatus, the cerebellum, and the corpus callosum. So it means that we're ready for this tremendous job, which should be totally natural, of reading. And if we put it younger on, when these physiological parts haven't tuned up for it, we cause, vision is probably the thing we cause the most problem with, which is very easy to detect. Other things are harder. I want to...
Same thing said about piano playing, that 7 or 8 is a much better time to start children on the piano than 5 or 6.
Because the cortex performs all those higher functions, and piano playing, driving the car, and all those things. Well, actually, knowing left and right, and you know, all the balance systems are there.
And my daughter just did a conference on teaching the deaf to read. And apparently one of the difficulties deaf children have is they have very little incentive to move past the pictorial level of reading.
Mm.
That they tend to stay in this one hemisphere. That it's the big jump is to get deaf children to about the 4th grade level of reading. Because that's when books lose their pictures, and it's also when the vocabulary becomes more abstract.
That's right.
So it's interesting how the sensation of hearing, if you don't have that, we have to learn new ways to get them to make the switch to the other half of the brain to think more abstractly and have an incentive for reading at a more complicated level.
If she's at the deaf, she's doing this at the deaf school.
She went to the deaf school for
a... You know, the deaf school in Los Angeles, the John Tracy Clinic, mm-hmm. is very old. I was asked to give a talk there because they knew I did three-dimensional things for learning. And I took, I had taken a big cardboard box and painted it, took another piece and made a roof over it, and cut windows. And each window behind the window inside the box, I had little milk cartons cut off about this deep. So, you know, then I put bread things and hooked them so every window you could go in like that. And little cloth curtains thing. And it had 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 windows, 2 and 4. And each window had a different kind of feeling thing, or it had a spoon in one, it had a whistle, it had many things, that little objects that could fit in there. And so the children would put their hand. I had used this with preschools, not with deaf children. But when I went there, I left one box empty. And so I gave it to the school, and then I had a letter, and she said, it's the first time we've been able to get the concept of empty. They couldn't find it. Empty was a hard word. And I had taken my tactile boards, even though they're deaf, the ability of sensation, the nervous system reaching the cortex through this kind of activity was very important for them to conceptualize the word with the picture, you know, soft and hard and everything, and then they could, you know, use the language too. So it's all the senses, and when you have one sense that's not off. I had the fortune to have a letter from Rhoda, Helen Keller, and I met her as a child. She influenced my whole life. I think it sent me on this path of knowing that we had, God gave us our senses and that they're vital to our whole being. And I was going to talk about that next week when we talk about sensations and that stuff.
I have a question to ask you, maybe it's two-part, is usually people, one side of the brain is dominant than the other side, and then I wonder, is it nature versus nurture, and is it the parents that help stimulate that? For instance, I know adults with mental retardation might have children, and the children might appear to have mental retardation, but it's because their adults cannot produce or stimulate that aspect in their growing.
You mean if mental retarded parents have a child?
No, I guess I'm trying to think, like, you know, if somebody's more right brain dominated, mm-hmm. is it because their parents are pretty much right dominated, or they stimulate the right brain?
I haven't heard that is the reason, because when we are conceived in the womb, we have eons of DNA that have come from our grandfathers and our great grandfathers, and are, you know, back and back and back, so that it's not only coming from our other, you know, our husband or the wife. It is from many, many places. And also the husband and wife. But I mean, that's, we are carrying the seeds of many generations through us. Mm-hmm. And I know that you have, most important for reading is that there should be a dominance. And children that haven't established a dominance are found to be the ones that have problems reading. So it's easy to establish a dominance if you don't let it go too long. You know, 3 and 4 still don't have it. They should be getting there for when you start looking at being able to have an idea of going on to reading. With children that don't, when I worked for the Help for Brain Injured Children Center, I volunteered, I did not work there. We would use a loofah sponge on the side that we thought was trying to be dominant, because if you have a child that you don't know, during the day, if you hand them something, like a spoon or whatever, or throw a ball, ball's not so good because it might take two hands, but anything you'd hand, the hand they reach out to, 2 out of 3 times will indicate that that's trying to be the dominant side. Then when you get that across, then you use a loofah sponge, and when you bathe the child at night, you rub that side with the loofah sponge, and it doesn't take long. And in the sleep position, you raise the side that you're trying to help dominance become. it's great if they sleep on their tummies, then you, and you want the right side, you pull the right arm up and you pull the left leg up. And the Institute for the Development of Human Potential used to get vegetable children, children that had been drowned in swimming pools, and had to have this established. And so these are the practices that they would, and I've used a lot of the loofah sponges, told parents to do that. It really is amazing. I have to stop. I'm sorry. But I'm so grateful that you came, because I know you all cared dearly for children. And if I could say a prayer to end, if I can find my little book. You know which, oh, here I'm. You know which book it is. This is one that I asked the library to have, besides this one, which is a great wedding gift. The little prayer is very short, and it's a poem, but it's for real, because it's the little person, the very little person, just asking, does he know I'm here? Does he take the time to listen? Does he care about the things I care about? Are they important to him? And does he really love me? So easy now for me to just believe the answer's yes. Plant the seed of faith within my heart. In later years, if I should struggle with a wiser mind, that faith will still be there, down deep, and it will blossom when I mature by going back to childlike faith. That's as important as all the tactile boards and everything else. Thank you very, very much for coming.